Hello and welcome. This is your Zlatan ASMR podcast. This is your host, Gabe Ledret. And that was not a joke. This is the show now. This is how we do it. I'm joined by Evan Matier, and we're going to read all of Zlatan Ibrahimovic's book on air right now.
That's what we're signed up for. We warned everybody.
We told you it was coming. The only problem is, okay, so this is your Leipzig football. We're not doing this Zlatan ASMR podcast. This is Gabe Ledret. I'm joined by Evan Matier. We were also currently joined by our friend Sheikh Khatiri, who we will talk to in a second, who is probably extremely creeped out by that intro, but I did want to do it because I had promised everyone this is your bonus show. Like, this is like bonus content. I wanted to bring that stuff up, though, because I found last night, Evan, that there's actually a dude who did that. So he read Zlatan's book, I Am Zlatan, in French ASMR. So
yeah, this is really upsetting, actually, because I thought we were onto something. You know, a kind of a new direction for the podcast. And so I don't like getting beaten to the punch. It's really annoying.
Yeah. I mean, I think we should sue him. And that's I think where we are. We're thinking about pursuing some legal action.
He pre-plagiarized us.
He is the,
Our idea before we did it. And that's not okay.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. Here's what we really should do. He can be the Winklevoss twins and we can be the Zuckerberg. We are more likely to be the Zuckerberg, Evan, because we're way more likely to be dragged in front of a Senate committee at some point in our lives.
Oh, my God. I can't wait until this podcast somehow gets us in front of a Senate subcommittee. That's going to be fun.
I can't wait for the poor, you know, congressional intern who has to transcribe every word of this show. That's going to enjoy that.
expletive.
So obviously, like, this show is bonus, and it's because we've been meaning to talk about it for a long time. The topic that we have, which is the Tehran Derby and some of the different things that went down there. But I wanted to begin by, you know, first of all, bringing up that guy. I'm going to splice in some of it. It is upsetting. we're not going to do it now. It's going to be at the very end of the show. I'm going to play some music so that you can, if you don't feel like listening to a guy mutter at you in French about Zlatan, you can turn the show off. But I'm going to put it in. It, like I said, it's upsetting. I found out, Evan, that Zlatan likes his own tweets occasionally, which, power move. I mean,
but why the hell wouldn't he, though? Like, that's exactly what Zlatan would do.
Power move.
Surprising no one that he would. I mean, why wouldn't it's a good tweet?
He likes
it. So why not like it?
Why wouldn't he like it?
He wouldn't post it if it wasn't a good tweet because he's Zlatan, so he likes it.
Oh man! And the Atlanta United fans last night after they beat LA Galaxy were taunting them. And one of their best ones was like, hey, LA Galaxy, you're welcome. It was pretty good, but don't ever insult Zlatan again. That's what
right.
I'll say
like,
to you.
Don't pretend like you are Zlatan or you could ever be Zlatan. You don't deserve to make Zlatan's jokes.
Right, exactly. Do not, you know, do not come at Zlatan ever.
You know, there is a line in Quran that says after God created humans, he said, congratulations to the greatest of all creators. So if anything, Zlatan is obviously God, so he can like his
tweets. God, that's a great fucking
point. Great point. It's a good point.
That's so good.
Strong point.
Such a good point.
And that's a really good lead in. That's the voice of Sheikh Khatiri. Shay is an Iranian who left Iran in 2011. He is pursuing a MA at Johns Hopkins School of International Studies and an MBA at Wharton. Simultaneously, he's part of what he describes as the Union for Democracy, Iran. And he has been blacklisted officially by the Iranian government. So we are by the way, his MA and MBA, that's on Iran, Iranian politics and a strategy on how to move forward against in the region and against Iran partially. So Shay, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for coming on to discuss this particular topic.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Did I do a good, okay job of describing what you're doing?
Excellent job.
Okay.
Excellent job.
Awesome.
Also, I want to point out that I was not creeped at all by that.
Oh, that's good.
Intro. I asked a very intellectual political podcast and by a friend of mine, and he once read Bigfoot Erotica on it. So this is not weird at all.
I'm glad that exists. I mean, that's good. It makes me happy that that exists. So why don't Shay, if you'd like, if you'd like to give a little bit of background about what we're talking about here, that'd be cool. But I'll just quickly explain that the basic, reason that we're discussing all this right now is that the Tehran Derby, is the biggest match in Iranian football. Iran currently prohibits women from attending matches. However, in the most recent Tehran Derby, Yanyan Infantino, the president of FIFA, who his Twitter handle is @Infantino, everyone should follow him. He was at the Derby, and at the same time, 35 women who had decided that they wanted to watch football dressed up as men and tried to enter the stadium. So the government officially said that they were detained, but we have a lot of different things to mention with respect to that. And the response from FIFA was at best underwhelming. So Shay, let's just start off. Why don't you give a little bit of context to what the Iranian government is thinking in prohibiting women from attending matches? Because as far as I understand, that's actually not the kind of custom across the Muslim world.
So, first of all, before I start, I encourage everybody to go and watch a movie called Offside. It's an Iranian movie from 10, 12 years ago. About a bunch of women in a football game and being detained. So, the context is that it is actually not the law of the land in Iran that women cannot attend football games or sport games. It is just a practice that the police does without any legal background, and it has become law by practice and tradition, not by legal code, which is super weird. And it happened in 1979 after the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and it was revolutionary times. The incoming regime was Islamic and very orthodox, so they tried to do something new. And you're correct that it's not the practice across the Middle East, except it was in Saudi Arabia until very recently that Mohammed bin Salman has reversed policy. But the difference is that all across the Middle East, the regimes have been there for a while, and they are not revolutionary. They are in accordance to what the public has been and the production of the of centuries of the public in those countries. Except in Iran, which the regime is revolutionary. So when they came into power, they began to reverse a lot of policies in existence. So that created an anomaly in the Middle East, in Iran, and very weird policies. So imagine Soviet Union, for example, which was a revolutionary regime and started practicing a lot of weird non-customary policies in Soviet Union, as well as any other revolutionary regime.
Interesting. So it's directly tied to the revolutionary government that was formed. That's actually fascinating, and it's some context also, right? I'd be interested in what you have to how you would like think about some of this stuff, which is the way no, go ahead, man. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I think there's a voice delay. No, you continue. Sorry.
Yeah. So I just one of the interesting things about what you're saying, right, is that one of the things that we do think about when we think about revolutionary governments or governments that are formed in this specific manner for doing these specific things is that they are able to at least maybe move and enact changes that are like they're weirder, but they're also like maybe can move quicker. And one of the things that have happened with especially with this law, which FIFA has been making whiny but ultimately fruitless noises about for almost 10 plus years now, is that the Iran, the government continues to say, yes, eventually this is going to happen.
So, yes, so, when you think of revolutionary regimes, they are not necessarily regressive or progressive. They could be either or none. Just what is revolutionary about them is that they go against the trend of the society at the time. And the trend of the society in Iran at the time was at least socially very progressive. And the trend of the revolution was that, okay, these progress are happening so fast. And secularization is happening in Iran. So let's reverse that. Let's go back to our Islamic orthodoxy that we have had. So that was the context of the revolution.
Interesting.
They come to power. They implement a lot of these practices. That women, the hijab becomes compulsory for women, especially at the beginning. It's not like that, and not that orthodox. But not a single hair for women could be shown. It's much less now. Men could not wear short sleeves. Men still cannot wear shorts in public. A lot of these weird trends. So the idea behind the reasoning behind not allowing women into stadiums has there have been several reasonings, quote unquote reasonings. One is that that men in shorts arouses women. which it's the weirdest thing on earth, because if you think about it, from I don't know 100 yards, you cannot see anything. But if you're watching it on TV, or if anybody gets aroused by many shorts, it's more likely to happen on TV, not
that is extremely good.
That is a really good point. I mean, you just think of, you know, probably somewhere in Iran they were televising, you know, the Juve Madrid match where, you know, Ronaldo tears his shirt off, and they're just very, very, very arousing.
But
don't
those
care who you are.
I mean, to be fair, that's true and fair. But the people at the top of the Bernabeu probably couldn't see those muscles.
Yeah,
really, like,
right,
don't really
exactly
understand what you're thinking.
Right. Yeah, the people in the stadium,
you know,
nothing.
I have a friend, a female friend here, who went to a Madrid game, and Ronaldo scored a hat trick, and she was really pissed that he didn't take off his shirt. So yeah, very
well,
good.
Shit.
Point.
Well, maybe so. Maybe they have a point then.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, they definitely have a point about men wearing shorts.
But there are a couple of flaws in that. One is that I don't think any football player in the world has that body. But saying it as a straight man, but back to the original point. So that's one of the problems that they have. That okay, so and which is total nonsense. The second one is that okay, we don't want men and women in very close proximity, sitting very close to each other, which is also weird because they could go to cinema or to the movies, to theaters or other close public events, concerts. They could go to concerts and sit next to each other, but this is just the taboo. And if you think about it, if you're in a football game, there are much more lights than if you're in the movie or if you're at the concert. So that also doesn't make sense. There is another one, which is they say there is a lot of cursing during football games in Iran. Yeah. A lot of cursing. It's basically if a player of so imagine how Real Madrid fans from 2006 to 2000 from 2000 3 to 2006 could not stop waving white clouds. That's equivalent to cursing for, and they do it nonstop in stadiums. And they say, okay, it is a violation of the sanctity of a woman in the stadium. And so we can, if men curse and women are there. Which again doesn't make sense, because if you go on the street in Tehran, everybody's cursing. Because doesn't make sense either.
Well, as you know, we are extremely against cursing on this show.
Yeah, we,
really we don't
fucking
do
hate
it.
Cursing. It's goddamn worse.
Oh, I fucking know.
But Shay, I'm really interested in one thing you said a second ago, which is that, you know, that this isn't like legally proscribed. There's like not a statute on the books saying women may not go to soccer matches. It's more like a custom that then the police enforce. And I'm curious, like, who then has like decision making power for enforcing this, and who would have decision making power for changing policy, and who is it like defending the policy? It's kind of weird when there's not like a strict statutory regime to like know who do you even complain at in order to try to change it.
So that is a very good question, and I can give you some answer, but not really. So there needs to be just a consensus within the regime. But let me just give you two examples of how unconventional the legal system is in Iran. For one is that my father was a political prisoner, and he was a member of the Communist Party, and I'm not a communist, by the way. he was a member of the Communist Party, and at the time when they were at the initial stages of the regime, first few years, the supreme leader, who's above the law, he can literally amend the constitution. So his word is above the constitution. He comes to power and says, okay, Maoists and Marxists are free to practice in politics. And my dad... they should run for office. My dad runs for the parliament. Later, a few years later, he gets arrested, and Marxism and Maoism are suddenly outlawed. And one of his charges he went to prison for was running for the parliament as a Marxist. Another one is that there was this political prisoner guy, a young student, and he gets arrested for stupid charges, and he is living in the U.S. actually right now, and he gets sentenced. So the judge tells him that, okay, I've summed up your sentence, and it's something like 150 years in prison, something like that. Okay, you're not going to survive 150 years in prison. I'm just going to give you death sentence. So it's that unconventional.
Interesting.
In
Iran.
So it's very arbitrary.
And so... Right now, the president could come out and say something, and the police could just say that we are not going to abide by that decision, and the president cannot do anything.
Right.
The only person who can make a finite decision is the supreme leader, and if he says something, if he just says something in a speech, that could be counted as the official law of the land. But, and 10 years later, something like that, the former president, who was actually a very conservative figure, very close to the Islamist wing of the society, he said that, okay, I'm going to allow women to go to stadiums. And that was a thing for a week, maybe less, until the supreme leader said, oh no, that's crap. And that stopped. That just stopped it. So it's the supreme leader. If at the the supreme leader's decision, at least publicly, it's just a power struggle that, okay, if they could pass a law through parliamentary process to make it happen. If not, if the president could have enough leverage to say, okay, stop arresting women. But it is really a chaotic process. It's a power game. Yeah.
So when Reuters, and I have this quote here, when Reuters reports that Rouhani, so I'm just literally quoting from Reuters, Rouhani, a pragmatist, has repeatedly criticized the ban on women going to football matches, but has been unable to get it removed because of resistance from powerful hardliners in the clerical and security establishment. The Islamic Republic has long barred Iranian women from attending male soccer matches, based at least in part on the theory that women should not hear male fans swear and curse. So their description of it seems like their description, assuming that premise that Rouhani actually does want to change this, may actually be true, that even if someone powerful like him wanted to make this change, it would actually require quite a bit of politicking in a way that maybe we don't, as kind of lay people, understand.
So if you points when they say Rouhani is a moderate, Rouhani has rebranded himself as a moderate. If we take him for his word, at best, by moderate he means that, okay, I'm going to moderately implement Islamist policies with a smile on my face, as opposed to a very beardy, ugly guy like Ahmadinejad being the conservative. But there's really not a difference between them. But even if we take him for his word that he's a little more moderate on social policy, you know, it uses the phrase security establishment. Rouhani, before becoming president, was the head of the National Security Council for over 10 years. So he is part of the security establishment in Iran. And funny thing about that, by the way, he has proposed to at least take a closer look at this issue. And guess where it's being discussed in Iran? National Security Council is trying to decide whether women should be allowed into the stadiums or not. you would think they have more urgent stuff to think about, right, like going to war with Israel. But no, women going to the stadium is a national security issue. So, and it really is. It really is a national security issue for Iran, because Iran's claim to power is that the regime's claim to power is that you fear us, and we are not going to allow. We're not going to cave to the public's demand so much, because we're going to rule by fear. So, if they actually make a concession to the people that we are going to give you something that you want, it is a show of weakness, and after that, people are going to start to demand more freedoms and more liberalization, and that's something that the regime cannot afford.
So that's a great point, and I just want to kind of refocus on the actual incident itself. Just to quote from and we'll go back to, because Evan and I have a number of questions, and I think interesting discussion about some of this other stuff later, but the lead organizer of a group called Open Stadiums, which is a couple of organizations that work on amplifying the plight of Iranian women, has said that, so the Iranian state has said that essentially all that happened was that these girls and women were moved to a different location, and it wasn't a big deal. But this person has said that the women who were arrested were actually held in Bozara prison, where women are kept for, quote, anti-morality felonies. So even though the women and girls were only officially detained, they now have this incident on their permanent records and could be taken in for more serious offenses if something like this reoccurs. So what this person is saying is essentially that, you know, and one of these, to be clear, one of the people that was detained was an 11-year-old, right? So this is a little child, and that down the line, this kind of event could be theoretically held against her, just like, I mean, to be clear, just like your dad running as a communist for government could be held against him.
So, first of all, the 11-year-old in any sane person's eyes is a child, but in Iran, actually, an 11-year-old has reached, an 11-year-old girl has reached sexual maturity. So she's a woman, according to Islamic law. And so if there was a court, I wouldn't think that she would be tried as an adult, and none of these women, as far as I know, are being tried in a court anyways. But theoretically, she could be charged by morality charges, mm-hmm. since that she has reached that. Think of it as when a Jewish girl has her bat mitzvah, mm-hmm. and according to Jewish law, she is a woman. But right. obviously, she's not looked at that way by public law, but she could be in Iran. Anyways, so the account that I read was that these women are arrested and they're removed to Vozara jail, and there they have their pictures, their mock shots taken, and they are held detained, and immediately there's a campaign starting to happen to have them released, and they are released after a couple of hours, and as soon as they're released, they come back. I apologize. So they are released from the stadium, from Azadi Stadium.
Right.
And as soon as they're released, police vans come and say, no, bullshit, we are taking you to jail. So one of them flees, actually. Everybody else is removed to, relocated to Vozara jail. And they are held there for a while. And some of their male family members come to protest or demand their release. And some of those male family members are detained then. And eventually, I think it was the same night that they were released, the government said that it will not be on their permanent record, but apparently that has been on their permanent record, mm-hmm. and that's never a good thing to have a file from Vozara jail, because Vozara jail is just for morality, quote unquote crimes. So it means that if you're arrested again for not having proper hijab, this could be a real pain in the butt for you. It is really weird. So they get eventually they get released. There are some lawyers trying to pursue their cases. They get them released, but the outcome for these particular women is that now there's at least an ambiguous question, mm-hmm. whether they have a permanent record or not. At least ambiguous, wow. if not certain.
So I think that, Evan, unless you have more, I think we have some interesting questions that are broader also, but I wanted to just now turn to the FIFA response, which I mentioned obliquely that Sepp Blatter had already talked about it. But so basically what happened was that Infantino was literally at this match and was apparently, told about what was going on. And he, you know, I'm going to read his statement about all of this after this all happened. So he did a press conference on VAR. I was actually trying to find the audio for this. I literally couldn't, but it doesn't matter. Here's his quotes. He received, quote, a reassurance from the Iranian president Hassan Rouhani that women won't be shut out of the stadiums for much longer, but no time frame was provided by Rouhani to change the law, and Infantino gave validation to the policy by attending the derby between men's teams. That's just a little added commentary from our friend Shireen. So he also said, this is basically what he said. Rouhani told me that in countries such as Iran, these things take a bit of time. And that while he was aware of the criticism of his visit, he felt it was, quote, better to engage in a dialogue with Iranian leaders. Quote, I heard there were some incidents where some women were detained because they wanted to attend a football match, and that there was some criticism, obviously and rightly. But there are two ways to deal with this matter. Either we criticize, we sanction, we condemn, we don't speak, and we cut relations, or we go ahead and have a discussion and try to convince the leaders of the country that they should give women access to stadiums. I went for the second option. How, what is this? What's going on here?
So, I need to give a general context again for a second. When you grow up in Iran and you go to high school, no matter where, it doesn't matter where you go, in south of Iran, center, north, where I'm from, the first question your classmate is going to ask you is, are you blue or red? Meaning, are you a Esteghlal fan, one team of the one side of the derby, or a Persepolis fan, the other side? So it is a huge, huge issue, especially in a country that social liberties are so restricted.
Right.
Football is actually one of the few refuges for young people. So, and it is a part of the culture. So in another context, since 1979, there have been three massive protests in Iran. One was over free speech. One was in 99. One was in 2009 over rigged elections. And one was in 2001 after Iran lost to Bahrain and did not qualify for 2002 World Cup. And an opposition TV just starts a rumor, God knows if it's true or not, that, oh, the match was rigged. The team was told to lose because the regime was scared that women and men are going to take the streets and dance together. There is a huge, massive protest in Iran over soccer that the regime was legitimately scared. That's how much Iranians care about soccer. So, I keep saying soccer, football. But, have that in mind. And in 2006, actually, Iran has a very abysmal showing at the World Cup and gets eliminated after. And the president at the time, Ahmadinejad,
right,
removes the head of the federation, the football federation. And Iran's football is suspended. And there was a huge, huge, huge... The guy was already unpopular. That was the final nail of the coffin that people were not going to reconcile with him ever again over football. Mm-hmm. So that's how much Iranians care about football. So yes, the FIFA president is trying to make the case that, excuse me, that yes, engagement is better with the Iranian people. But the fact is that Iran, for the first time in the history, has qualified for the second World Cup in a row. And just the threat of suspension of Iran's football, that just the threat that we're not going to let you, a serious threat, that we're not going to let you play in the World Cup, is going to drive Iranians crazy against the government, that they're going to be so scared of just the fact that we might get suspended, the people are going to lynched us publicly, so we are going to make some changes.
So
I don't agree that it takes a very long time of engagement, because 40 years is a very long time to have a change.
I totally agree with that. That's a really good point, and it actually stands exactly. We had meant to bring up and I mean, to be quite frank, like, that threat is like one of the things that FIFA really can do. And Evan, I think when we were discussing this, you rightly reminded us that FIFA are very willing, right, to involve themselves when they feel like local law may be not allowing them to make, you know, money, basically, right? So they say, we're going to go in and you have to change the laws of your country. If you, like, for example, the classic example is, right, the quote from Jerome Valk about not selling, you know, Brazil not selling beer, and well, they have to change the law, which I'll play.
Let there be beer. That is the clear message from the world's highest football authority, FIFA, to the host of the 2014 World Cup, Brazil. Beer has been banned in football stadiums here since 2003, an attempt to reduce violence between rival clubs. But FIFA's Secretary General Jerome Valk was adamant.
It's part of the FIFA World Cup. So there will be, I'm sorry to say, and maybe I look a bit arrogant, but that's something we'll not negotiate. I mean, there will be, and there must be, as part of the law, the fact that we have the right to sell beer.
He spoke to reporters in Rio de Janeiro after touring stadiums across the country with former football star Ronaldo and Brazil's sports minister Aldo Rebelo. The minister has repeatedly said Brazil would meet its commitments, but he needs Congress to come through for him.
The government sent them a general law based on its 12 commitments.
But yeah, so Evan, do you want to like expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. So like, I mean, this is maybe the most infuriating part of Infantino's comments is, you know, so he presents this dichotomy, right? Either we can, you know, play hardball and say if you don't make changes, then there's going to be repercussions, or we can go in there and have, you know, what he calls a dialogue and try to work it out. And like you kind of previewed, that is totally not FIFA's approach when it comes to anything that makes them money, right? So when it comes to selling beer in stadiums at the World Cup, when it comes to changing laws with respect to tax, you know, tax laws, liabilities, everything else that they require host countries and host cities for the World Cup and other tournaments to do, you know, these are not like, oh, we'll go have a dialogue with you about, you know, what's best for Chicago. It's no, if you don't make these changes, you're not going to be participating in this tournament. You're not going to host this tournament. You're not going to play like, it is much more clear and straightforward. But when there's no money on the line, or when the, or more, maybe more accurately, when the profit motive cuts the other way, you know, suddenly now it's time for, you know, for private dialogue that also, you know, the second thing that's infuriating about Infantino's comment to me is, you know, the route that he says he wants to do. Well, that all happens privately. It all happens quietly. There's no measure for success. There's no benchmarks. There's, you know, it's completely opaque. So he can say he's having dialogues all day long, and we have no idea what's happening or if anything's happening. There's no way to measure it.
Right. Exactly. I think that one thing that I did want to kind of focus on also, Shay, if you're interested in talking about this, but one of the things that we see a lot in this country, especially right now, is that people use the kind of the really terrible actions, right? These unacceptable fascistic repressive actions of the Iranian government to kind of push a very anti, you know, xenophobic Islamic, anti-Islam narrative, basically, you know, that we've seen a lot in, especially in this country over the last like year or so. And I'm just interested in your like position, like your understanding of maybe how do we go about like kind of threading this needle where we correctly and appropriately criticize regimes for acting in fascist, right, like repressive, awful ways, but also don't give fire and don't give fuel to the, you know, homegrown, you know, anti-Islamic racists who would use any criticism of any regime in the Middle East to say how bad Islam is. Like, how do you think we should go about like threading that needle, basically?
Okay, so it's a very difficult question. The only way you can do that is to say, when you're speaking, to say that we as a country, I as a leader of this country, really, really, really hate the government of Iran or whatever, North Korea, and what pains me is, how it's against United States national interests, how they're behaving, and two, how these noble people of the country of X or Y are being treated by this monstrous government. So the interest of the American people and the Iranian people or the North Korean people or you name it, or Egyptian people, are aligned to have better leaders, and we want that for ourselves and for the people of Iran who are noble and decent and we love them, although that's giving us too much credit, but that's the way to approach. But it's actually something interesting. I mean, yes, some of the rhetoric are harmful to Middle Easterners inside the United States, or for that matter in Europe too. But in last year, in September or October, Thomas Erbrink, who's a chief correspondent of New York Times in Iran, had a piece that Trump's tough rhetoric on Iran has rallied the people behind the regime. In December, massive protests. Hundreds of thousands of people are pouring into the streets demanding regime change. And President Trump had just a tweet, because that's how, I guess, we make policy nowadays, that, by the way, I support I support the Iranian people, and I hate the regime, and I support Iranian people's quest for freedom. And Ambassador Nikki Haley gives a speech, and at the time, I was talking to my family and friends in Iran, and if you had a presidential election in Iran, Trump and Nikki Haley would go to the runoff by a great margin. So inside Iran, people actually, yes, the Iranians are very egotistical people, and they love being talked about how great their history is, our history is. But at the end of the day, they don't care what the rhetoric of a leader in the West is, as long as you, as long as that leader says, "Oh, I'm with you guys for in your quest for freedom against this barbaric regime."
Right. So I'm wondering less about like, and maybe it's the wrong thing that I'm focusing on, but I'm wondering less about like how our rhetoric from our country, you know, resonates with the people of Iran, and more, and like I know that is more of like what you're interested in policy wise, which I think is extremely interesting, but it's not exactly what I was asking.
Yeah.
And it's more about like in our country, in the kind of popular culture, right, and which we are admittedly sort of a part of, doing podcasts and talking about, you know, stuff, whatever. There is like this dynamic to that basically from a number of like quite, you know, disingenuous and bad sources, not to talk about
yes,
you know, the Iranian people, but to talk about how the Iranian government show like and the excesses and the fascisticness of the Iranian government is, instead of being about a political system, is really just shows that all of Islam is bad. Everyone who is Islamic and who is a Muslim in the United States is our enemy, and all of that. And I think the question I was asking is, how do we combat that narrative, that rhetoric in this country, when we buy, even though we're also like saying, yeah, we need to be able to criticize these absolutely terrible, shitty fascist governments.
So strictly speaking, in context of Iran, I think the best way is to make the point that, listen, the Islamic Republic is an anomaly in the history of Iran. It's not a natural outcome. This is an anomaly, not a regularity. But in the broader context of the Middle East and Islam and Muslims, well, first of all, I think we need to make a clear point that we really don't want 1 billion enemies.
Right.
like, we need to make that point clear, because not all Muslims are, vast majority of Muslims are not the enemies of the American people or the West. But if we make them, it's going to be a big shit show. But second is,
and like framing this right, just to be clear, like framing this as a war between the West and Islam is actually like exactly what a lot of these horrible people in the Middle East want, right? They want to view this as a, you know, a war between, yeah.
They want to say that after all, they want to make the point that it's a tribal war, and by the end of the day, we have our internal disagreements, but we are the same tribe, they are not. And that's a very bad, I think the right approach is to make the clear point that, listen, just like Christianity, there are a bunch of denominations in Islam, many, and some are good, good, some are bad. We need to be honest with people that some are very bad, like the Islamic State or the Islamic Republic in Iran. And most of them are very good, and that's how we need to demonstrate. Right. And also, that's a criticism that I have had on Muslims in the West, that they also need to be very quick to, and they have been actually very good since the birth of the Islamic State, to organize themselves, to distinguish themselves, and they show what good people they are, as opposed to the more extremist and more radical wing.
Right.
Because
it's not by the end of it's not fair to make them to make that happen. But I understand like why, like as a Muslim in the United States, you might say like, shoot, I need to show everybody that this is not like Islam. This is not me. That being said, it's of course incredibly unfair and bullshit that we would end up in a culture that would force them to do that, right?
Yeah, but yes, I understand how it's not fair. But also, you know, I was born in Iran and you were born in the U.S. So overall, and you were born in Philly, so it's not really a good analogy. But life is not fair. Sometimes you have to deal with the hand you have.
Yeah, you know, on the question, you know, of how we, you know, how we try to differentiate between, you know, the religion and the regimes and stuff like that, I wonder if it becomes a little bit trickier when it moves, you know, I know we're focused on Iran here, but I couldn't help when I was thinking about how FIFA was dealing with this kind of a parallel issue with respect to Morocco's World Cup bid, which is there's been criticism of their bid because homosexuality is illegal in Morocco. And technically the bid requirements have LGBT protection,
now,
you know, human rights protection requirements.
Now they do, right? They didn't.
Yeah, now they do. They didn't before, but they currently do. So for the 2020, whatever, what are we talking about? 2026 World Cup. you know, for the 2026 World Cup, it's a requirement. And it raises sort of a similar issue with respect to, you know, FIFA going into a local, you know, a local country, different culture, a Muslim culture, and, you know, importing with it, you know, these values about, you know, LGBT rights, and saying, you know, they've said softly that they think this law needs to be changed in order for the bid to go forward. And I wonder, Shay, if you have any thoughts on what FIFA's role is in a situation like that. You know, how much do you think they should be pushing to get Tehran to change policy on stadiums, you know, as an organization, as FIFA as an organization? How much should they be pushing to get Morocco, which is a less antagonistic regime, right? It's harder for them to go after the regime with Morocco. It's going to be more of a cultural push. How much do you think FIFA as an organization should be held to, you know, to pushing for that change, given that they're considering putting a World Cup there?
So I'm not very fond of that rule that, for example, LGBT protection rights, because we need to have some standards, but also we need to realize that there is a difference between a country that's progressing and a country that's regressing. And Morocco, or for that matter, actually Tunisia is progressing on social issues very fast. I'm not that much familiar with Morocco, but a country like Tunisia, which is progressing really fast, we need to encourage them. We need to give them encouragement, to tell them that, okay, we understand that you're not perfect by any means, but you're moving into the right direction. So we are going to help you. We are going to bring the World Cup there, which generates a lot of growth for you guys. It familiarizes your people with Western culture, liberal culture that we want to spread. And that's a good thing. And also, you're doing the right thing. You're moving in the right direction. So we are going to give you some treats, to use dog metaphors. But if you're Egypt, who is rapidly regressing, we're not going to be very nice to you guys. So I think that we could make some accommodations like that. But as for, you know, like we have given Qatar the World Cup. I knew Gabe was gonna love this, but you know, if Qatar is going to host the World Cup, I'm more than fine with Morocco.
There's a level of hypocrisy, right, with this. Where, so let's be clear, Russia also has anti-homosexuality laws on its books. So, dealt with some of this stuff with the Russians, right, with the Olympics being held there. That the United States sent a delegation there that was led by Billie Jean King, right? Like, I'm pretty sure. So, like, who was, like, the first one of the first out lesbian tennis players and all this stuff and made a big statement. But, you know, they still gave the World Cup to Russia. They still gave all this stuff to Russia because ultimately it's all about the money. But I think that, Shay, you're making some interesting and correct points. And I really do. I think there's a shitload of hypocrisy and suddenly this is their big thing. That being said, I am more, I guess, willing to live with some of the FIFA hypocrisy if it means that if there's, like, for example, I don't see what's wrong with, like, a whisper and underhanded campaign saying, look, you don't really, I mean, if you guys have a real issue with this, like, fine and keep it on your books, but if you guys are ready to change this law, that might be a big part of why you might get this bid. That actually seems to me like an unquestionably good thing.
Yeah, I agree.
but obviously, the fucking hypocrisy is absurd, right? Because, like, you know, they talk a big game about all this stuff, but then as soon as it's anything else, like, I mean, like, just look at, I mean, for real, like, they spend so much time talking about how they don't intervene in politics, and then they literally go and change, you know, require that places change their laws. Like, if the United States were to win the bid, there are a lot of places that would have liked to host games that would have literally had to change state laws to allow for it. And FIFA basically said, yeah, that's what you'd have to do.
Yeah, and I suppose that's kind of, you know, one thing that my question was getting at is, you know, it's not just, you know, how do we feel about giving a World Cup to, you know, a country that, you know, bans homosexuality? Like, it's not just like, Gabe, like, you and I are on the record of hating both the Russia and Qatar World Cup bids, right? And, you know, it's not just how we feel about that. But then second is, like, how do we feel about FIFA being the organization that's the advocate for these issues? You know, that's a thing I'm not dealing. So, like, I feel fairly strongly that, like, regardless of the hypocrisy because Qatar got the World Cup bid, the Morocco shouldn't get a World Cup bid unless it can actually, you know, guarantee the safety of all the fans who want to come there, including gay fans. Like, I feel pretty strongly about that. But on the flip side, I have absolutely no faith or trust in FIFA being the advocate for this type of policy because they're such a shitty organization and they're so corrupt and so hypocritical. And so it's a really tough thing. And that, you know, this, you know, kind of ties back to, you know, the Tehran issue because, you know, I have a lot more faith in organization like, you know, like we quoted from Open Stadiums and other people who are advocating for women in stadiums. I don't know that FIFA brings a lot extra that's good to this situation.
That's a really good point, dude.
Go ahead.
It's like, when has involving FIFA in these discussions ever gone well?
Yeah.
Anybody has ever received a bag of money in FIFA to go for.
No, it's exactly right, though. What else would we expect to happen except for Infantino will go and have, like, a $1,000 steak dinner with Rouhani, and there'll be some marketing concessions, and then everyone, you know, he'll say, you know, that'll be secret, and then he'll say, oh, yeah, you know, they said that they're going to work on it.
Yeah, in a couple of years, they'll work on it as Rouhani, like, backs up these trucks full of, like,
the money truck
cartoon sacks of gold.
Exactly.
So, like, let me just give you one example about Iran, which is kind of funny, but when, I think it was the last election of Sepp Blatter, and the Iranian, the previous head of the federation in Iran, who was the head of the federation at the time, so he was telling this story that, yeah, it was a closed ballot, and we would go behind the curtain and cast our ballot. And I went to Sepp Blatter and said, I'm voting for you. That basically means that, yeah, I'm going to do some shitty stuff, but I have your back, have my back.
Oh, my God. It's really good. I love it. I love it. This is extremely on brand. This is extremely Let's Fix Football. Shay, thank you so much for coming on the show. This is really, really interesting.
Can I make...
Yeah, you want to make...
Just two more points.
Sure, man. Go
very
ahead.
Quickly.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Yeah, two... Very quickly. Is the amount of leverage against Iran. For example, Iran is not a member of the copyright agreement. So Iran actually pirates every single La Liga, EPL, Euro game, all of them. And airs them on national TV. Second, actually, I don't think this stadium issue is going to go away anytime soon because Iranians are, for the better or for worse, ex-Arabs, and especially against Saudis. And this issue came into prominence again on a much later. Mohammed bin Salman allowed women to go to stadiums in Saudi Arabia. So Iranian with a great, great, huge sense of superiority against Arab women, thinking they're much more sophisticated, much more pretty, whatever you say, they think they are over Arab women. So they had a huge, huge problem with their ego that Saudi women can now go to stadiums and we can't, so we have to change that. So those are my final points.
Interesting. Well, we'll see, and of course if there are any developments we'll have to have you back on, but again, thanks so much. That's Shay Kateri, thank you so much for coming on. Evan, we'll talk soon. We have Stephen Mandis possibly coming on the show to talk about a new article he wrote about the future of football. We're really excited about that. And just a reminder, I'm going to play us out with some music, but then I am going to give you guys a few minutes of that French Latin ASMR, dude, because that's real. That's not a fake thing. I want to make sure we all know that's happening.
I am for sure going to be skipping ahead to that when I listen to this on the way to work tomorrow.
Okay, because
I wonder when Zlatan is going to publish his own Zlatan erotic.
Oh, my God. That's such a good
point. That's a really good point. Oh, my God.
We already have some like sports erotica, right? We have a precedent, a night in Gronkowski. All right. So I'll talk to you both soon. Thanks, guys.
Of death or glory, to be learned by heart by all children of men. It's the hour of the morning, on the day after the dawning, when the sun they said would never set, finally set again. Was it Cromwell or Orwell who first led you to the stairwell, which leads only forever to kingdom come? Rushed along by guiding hands, whispers of the promised land, they wished you luck and handed you a gun. Life could be so handsome, life could be so gay. Putting to right all of the world's great wrongs. Yes, we thought that they were brothers, then they half murdered each other. Then he did a karaoke turn and murdered our best song.
Told the governor's wife about the last night of his life. She turned away in tears, called you a liar. Where are all the old dreams now? The battalions once so proud, lost in some old song and hanging on the old barbed wire. Well, life could be so handsome, it's all gonna be okay. We're going nowhere, but nowhere, nowhere's on our way.
vous savez peut-être, Zlatan Ibrahimovic est un joueur qui joue au Paris Saint-Germain. Mais j'aime beaucoup le caractère de ce joueur. Et j'aime également sa façon de jouer au football. Que ce soit ses gestes techniques. Enfin voilà quoi, j'aime vraiment beaucoup ce joueur. Alors, comme je vous l'ai dit, ce livre est une autobiographie. Donc, voici le contenu. Je suis désolé si la caméra tremble. Je filme en fait avec mon téléphone portable. Et comment expliquer? En fait, je tiens avec une main mon téléphone et avec l'autre main, vous pouvez voir que je tapote le livre. Donc, si vous pouvez me conseiller une technique pour que je puisse maintenir mon portable exactement à un angle de vue similaire et qu'en même temps je puisse utiliser mes deux mains, ce serait gentil de me donner ce conseil là. De sa vie personnelle. Donc là, vous pouvez voir les pieds de Zlatan Ibrahimovic qui sont, ma foi, en assez piteux état. Là, voici des photos de lui étant enfant, ainsi que son club dans lequel il a commencé à jouer. Désolé si le focus ne marche pas très bien, mais comme je vous l'ai expliqué, je tiens le téléphone à une main. Et de ce fait, vu que je tremble, le téléphone est constamment en mouvement, ce qui empêche le focus. Voilà Zlatan avec Lionel Messi. Cette photo, Zlatan Ibrahimovic a inauguré un terrain à Rosengard, la ville où il a vécu étant enfant. Là, c'est une photo chez son père. Donc à gauche, vous pouvez voir le père de Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Ici, je pense peut-être ses enfants, mais je ne suis pas sûr. Là, c'est Zlatan. Avec Patrick Vieira. Voilà. Avec un titre à la main. Je ne saurais pas vous dire lequel c'est. Non, je ne sais pas. Voilà. Zlatan Ibrahimovic a également été élu meilleur joueur de l'année de Serie A. Je ne pourrais pas vous dire la date. Elle est magnifique cette photo de Zlatan avec Pelé, qui est un Brésilien. Pelé qui est un Brésilien et qui est également une très grande légende du football.